Hey, folks, I know there are lots of business owners who listen to this show. Maybe some of you never planned on running a business, but now here you are. One thing you've always got to keep in mind is how much you're spending on your operating costs. That's one of the first things we had to keep in mind with WTF. And with things costing more today than they did when we started, you want to keep your expenses down. To reduce costs and headaches, be smart and use NetSuite by Oracle, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth. Reduce IT costs, cut the costs of maintaining multiple systems, improve efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. By popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/WTF for more. That's NetSuite, NetSuite.com/WTF.
Lock the gates!
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck, buddies? What the fuck, Nicks? What is going on out there? I'm Mark Maron. This is my podcast, WTF. Welcome to it. This is the 1500th episode. Is that a big deal? It's a lot of episodes. It makes me feel like sometimes if I don't know if I've talked to somebody or not, that I'm not losing my mind. It's just hard to keep it all in my head. There's been times recently where I'm like, did we interview that guy? I don't know. I got to go check myself. It's like my part of my brain is the website for this podcast and Brendan McDonald's memory. Those are two functioning parts of my mind right now in terms of how long it's been and what we've been doing here. Anyway, look, 1500. Now, look, I want to talk about it for a minute because, as some of you know, over the years, we've done special episodes for these 00 episodes, okay? Yes, it's a milestone, 1500, but it's also just another episode. And the last time we tried to, I remember for the 1000th, we reached out to Bob Dylan. Well, it was like this big process, and I've probably told this story before, but it was just one of these revelatory moments where the booking agents told me, like, hey, maybe you write a handwritten letter. So I write this handwritten letter, and I scan it, and I send it off to Bob Dylan's guy, and it's very thoughtful, and it's for the 1000th, you know. And then the bookers recommend I just call Rosen, that's Dylan's guy. Call Jeff, just talk to him. So I got on the phone with Jeff Rosen, Dylan's guy. And I'm like, so listen, Jeff, we met a few years back. I met him years ago when I was at Short Attention Span Theater. And he's like, yeah, I remember. And I'm like, well, look, we got this 1000th episode, and it's a kind of a big deal for us, big deal for our listeners. And we just think it'd be amazing if maybe Bob Dylan would be the 1000th guest on my amazing podcast. What are the chances of that happening, Jeff? And Jeff said, zero. Zero. He said he's got no axe to grind. He's not very good at them anyways. And I'm like, well, thanks for that. But that told me a couple of things, It was like, all right, well, maybe this isn't as big a deal as as I think it is. My show. We ended up having a great show without him, despite that. But this one, now, yes, look, I've talked to a lot of people. There are very few people that I haven't talked to that I really want to talk to. And we were thinking about how we were going to do this. And the truth is, this is just another episode when it comes right down to it. Look, if we've done our jobs here, episode 1500 should be as true to the show as episode 100 or 500 or 1400. We always wonder if we should do something special. But the truth of the matter is, like, look at Albert Brooks. Albert Brooks was a guest who definitely fits the description of a 1500th episode guest. Now, we got Albert Brooks, and he wanted his episode to air close to the release of his documentary in November. And he also, between us, thought that being the 1500th guest would be too much pressure. So he was happy that it didn't time out right. That's true. Now, I think what happened during this talk with Paul Giamatti is actually the ideal version of what can happen when someone shows up in my garage and it just clicks. And this happens a lot. It's not a rare thing, but it's been happening pretty consistently for 1,500 shows. And this show with Paul, we did it a couple weeks ago, and we kind of sat on it. And I said right after it was done, I said, that one's a great one. I mean, that's exactly what we do here. I mean, look, when I started this show, I was just trying to reconnect with my community, to talk to my peers. There was a lot of apologizing going on. At the beginning, there was no real professional boundary there. I don't have boundaries. They were still on my show. I was going to talk. I was there to talk to them. And as I tell people sometimes when they ask me, you know, how I develop my interview process, I'll say, look, for the first 100 episodes, it was just me inviting celebrities over to talk about my problems. The point is, those conversations were engaged. They were familiar. They were with people I kind of knew almost. But now, as time went on, people got more famous. They got more notable. And my life grew bigger because of this podcast. I mean, even when we did Robin Williams, who was certainly more famous and more notable, but I kind of knew that guy. You know, we knew of each other. But, you know, then we had a president on. I didn't know that guy. I did not know President Barack Obama before he came to my house. No idea. I had a sense of who he was and what he'd done. I knew what his job was, but that's the point. My life over time grew because of this podcast. It grew to include broadening my audience, building a bigger audience, having a successful stand-up career, having my own show on IFC, having a successful acting career, kind of getting more skilled and deeper with what I do here and all other parts of my life. I mean, it really has changed. Some things haven't changed, okay? Some things haven't changed. Like, for instance, I just quit nicotine again. For those of you who've been with me since the beginning, how many fucking times have I been through this cycle? I'm at the end of my rope right now. Every nerve, I'm on my last nerve. Is that what they say? I'm a fucking raw nerve right now. Because I do the same thing with nicotine all the time. Some of you know this. This is a consistent pattern. There are consistent patterns in my life. But in terms of my abilities creatively, personally, with this show, with the other things, with acting, that's all evolving. I'm definitely a different guy. But God damn, I want some nicotine. I'll be all right. I get to the point I hit a wall and I think that, you know, my pancreas is going to fall out and everything's shutting down. And I got off. But it's like the excitement of deep addictive craving is not to be fucked with. Woo-hoo-hoo-hoo. It's something, man. I'm lit up. And I know the only thing that can put it out is some nicotine. I'm not going to have it. Look, some things about me are consistent. Some of my behavior, some of my tics, some of my habits, they're consistent. But over the arc of this podcast, who I am in the world, my skill set, my creativity, how I engage with people, the depth I've been able to access in myself and others has all expanded and changed. I mean, here's the deal, and this is why on the 1500th episode, I'm going to be sitting here with a guy who's on an Oscar campaign, and I'm having the same type of kind of engaged, connected, authentic conversation that I had with my comedian friends when I started out on this show, however many years ago was that. And now I can speak about a different skill set, and now I can create a familiarity with people who I wouldn't have early on. I didn't even really like to have actors on early on. But that's not the point. Obviously, the connection between me and Paul is deeper than, you know, acting or whatever. We just hit it off. And I can do that with a lot of people. And I don't know where it's going to go. And I just knew when I was done with this thing, it was a great episode. And the bottom line is that a lot has changed in 1,500 episodes, but some very important things haven't changed at all. And that is why it is still rewarding to do this. I don't know what's going to happen. I did not know what was going to happen with Paul. I assume that things are going to happen that don't. And usually that's a good thing. But it's sort of fucking amazing that we're still operating at this level. And here's the thing about what we do here is that you listen to this Paul Giamatti episode and you kind of get an, you know, Paul Giamatti, right? You know him, right? You got a good sense of Paul Giamatti, but you don't really. I didn't. And I think he may have surprised himself during this conversation. It's just something happens in this room and in the old garage and on these mics and in that chair across from me that the president sat in. Something happens sometimes where there's such an honest, candid, connected engagement that you get a very full sense in a very deep way. Even if the conversation isn't deep, you get a very full sense in a very deep way of who we are. Because it's not about information. It's about connection. And that's really the nuance of, one, doing audio, and two, not doing a structured journalistic interview, whatever those are. But I just feel like, yeah, you think you know Paul? Now you will. I don't think you did before. That's all I'm saying. That's the best I can do. So, folks, I'm at Largo in Los Angeles on Tuesday, January 9th. San Diego, I'm at the Observatory North Park on Saturday, January 27th for two shows. San Francisco at the Castro Theater on Saturday, February 3rd. Portland, Maine, I'm at the State Theater on Thursday, March 7th. Medford, Massachusetts, outside of Boston at the Chevalier Theater on Friday, March 8th. Providence, Rhode Island at the Strand Theater on Saturday, March 9th. Tarrytown, New York at the Tarrytown Music Hall on Sunday, March 10th. Atlanta, Georgia, I'm at the Buckhead Theater on Friday, March 22nd. Madison, Wisconsin at the Barrymore Theater on Wednesday, April 3rd. Milwaukee, Wisconsin at the Turner Hall Ballroom on Thursday, April 4th. Chicago at the Vic on Friday, April 5th. And Minneapolis, I'm at the Pantages Theater on Saturday, April 6th. Go to WTFpod.com/tour for tickets. All right. So, Paul Giamatti, I love the guy. Who doesn't love Paul Giamatti? I mean, how is that not everyone's one of their favorite actors? I mean, come on. I watch Sideways two or three times a year. I love that fucking movie. This new movie he's in, The Holdovers, he's great. There's an intensity to him. I just watched Cinderella Man again. Great. You guys, this is one of our great American actors. This is Paul Giamatti. But this is our 1500th episode. And I did not know, I never know what's going to happen. But let me tell you something. Whatever happened with me and Paul in this talk happened right away, and it stuck. It stayed there. So The Holdovers is now streaming on Peacock and playing in select theaters. This is a classic WTF episode for our 1500th with the inimitable Paul Giamatti. Sometimes I wish I paid more attention in school, or in some cases, any attention at all. There are probably a lot of things I could have gotten more out of, like literature, and now it's probably not in the cards to go back to school and study the classics. But luckily for us, there's a new podcast called The Foxed Page that dives deep into the best books of all time. This is basically like the best possible college English class, but more relaxed and fun. No pressure of grades or needing to prepare something to say in class. It's only the books you want to read and know about, presented by best-selling author Kimberly Ford. Everything from Cormac McCarthy to Madame Bovary, from classics like Frankenstein to modern hits like Lessons in Chemistry. I love Ireland, but I missed the boat on James Joyce. The Foxed Page has a three-part series on Dubliners, and that's a pretty great starting point. Want to get the most out of what you read? The Foxed Page is for you. Get it now wherever you get your podcast. Well, that's what happened to me on the at the other place. Like, it was a cute house and everything, but I had a lot of history there.
Yeah.
A lot of things went down. Yeah. A lot of things good. A lot of things bad.
That's part of what it is.
Yeah, layers of stuff.
Yes.
And when I finally,
when a girlfriend finally, you know, found this house, she said, what about this one? I'm like, I'll buy it. I'll buy that house.
Yeah.
I don't miss that fucking place at all.
Yeah. I don't think I'd miss. I have a lot of books.
Yeah.
Which is great, but then they start to feel, that starts to feel crazy. And I start to feel, I said the other day, I feel like, you know, the Collier brothers were? They were the two kind of really crazy, I think they were twins.
Yeah.
And they lived in New York in sort of the early 1900s.
Right. Okay.
And they were super, I think they were really wealthy and hoarding. And,
oh, yeah.
And one guy got buried under the bookshelf falling over on him. And the other guy couldn't find him. And I was like, and for some reason, I just feel like, the books are great, but they're actually depressing me now.
I got a whole room of them. But let me ask you a question. I mean, I know you grew up in academia to a degree.
Yeah.
But I always aspired to having the books.
Me too.
And like I used to talk about like, you know, and I look at the books and maybe in a third of them, there's a bookmark at page 30.
Maybe. There's so many of them are abandoned. And it's just the whole thing is actually getting depressing to me.
Well, that's because we're getting to a certain age.
Well, there's that too, but it's a compulsion too. It's like I can't stop buying them.
You so still then do?
Which makes me feel crazy.
What was the last book you bought?
Oh, I just bought a bunch. I just bought like 10 books. I come out here. One of the reasons I like coming out here.
Yeah.
And actually, Glendale's interesting.
Yeah.
One of the reasons I like coming out here is there's really good used bookstores out in L.A.
Okay.
Most
so what were you searching for?
like old shitty sci-fi books.
Oh, that's good.
Oh, it's great.
Yeah.
But I have way too many of them. And now I'm the guy who's like, I'm going to have 5 editions of the same thing just because I like the different covers.
Sure. You're a completist? You have to have...
I don't know. No, it's like, it's compulsive.
It's just like, that's a new one.
It's a mania. Yeah. Yes. Oh, that's a cool cover.
It's weird. I kind of stopped... buying books is I was always the guy that would buy the books, you know, like the postmodern philosophy that I could never understand.
Never read them.
Never understand.
I have a lot of that shit.
Well, I used to do it.
Never read it.
I try.
Dude, me too. Never read it.
Well, the observation I had, and I've said it on stage before, is that the thing about those books is like, oh, look at these books.
Oh.
And I'll underline, dude.
Oh.
I'll underline.
Sure.
But like... But I retain nothing.
Nothing.
But
and it's almost like just having the thing itself, I'm somehow going to absorb something from it.
Well, that's what I realize is that when you're reading it, it feels like you're thinking it.
Yes, and that's true.
And then it's
but
over.
You're not.
You're
no, totally. Then it's gone.
It's gone.
It's gone. And I have that. I have a ton of science books.
Oh.
Physics and all
physics.
Of the quantum shit. But I understand. And I try. And talk about a bookmark at about 10 pages in. And I'm
you
done.
You try with physics.
I try with all kinds of science.
I remember when I was younger when chaos theory was a thing.
Yes, exactly. 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 All of that kind of shit.
I got to get that.
Love it.
Yeah.
Oh, this is fascinating. And I get the gist.
Yeah,
that's sort of good enough.
Yeah, but
I have the gist of a lot of things.
Yeah, and just so you can, when people bring it up, you can at least nod in agreement without lying, knowing that you read it, but you can't really engage in the whole conversation.
Yeah, yeah, that's really interesting.
And now I get sent books from, you know, publishers and people.
Oh, I bet.
You know, and there was a lot of that going on, and some of that, I've grown able to get to unload them, but I still have the core bunch.
Yes, I know what you mean. Yeah.
I have the core bunch of about like 1,000 or 1,500.
Easily, yeah.
And then, like, here's the other thing about the books is, like, you can start to smell the paper rot.
Oh, yeah.
So that room, but I kind of like it because I have
I
the
do
room.
Too.
Like, this was all in my old garage, but the smell of that.
No, I realized.
It's specific.
I realized, I was going to say to you, one of the reasons I used to come, the only reason I would come to Glendale when I come out here. Was there were a bunch of good used bookstores.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been obsessed with used bookstores my whole life.
Yeah.
And then I realized what I've done to my apartment is
you've
I've recreated a used bookstore. And it smells like the fucking place. And I'm not kidding. I swear to God, what I've done is created a used bookstore.
Yeah.
And,
well, let me know when you open it to the public.
I'm thinking about it. I've thought about it.
I've thought about that too. But then even if you want to have a garage sale, they're going to come to your house.
They're going to come to my house and they're going to take shit. And I'm going to be like, no, not that one.
Yeah. Be that guy.
Yes.
It seems like you have your future planned.
And they're going to take me feet first out of the thing in a hefty bag.
Yeah,
just
after
dead.
After they lift the bookshelf off
totally.
You.
Totally. Totally. It's going to happen.
But how big is the place? 2-bedroom?
Yeah, it's a two-bedroom. Yeah. It's a nice place, but it's all books shelves. The whole apartment's bookshelves.
And you don't have a house somewhere?
No, I don't have a house. I used to have a house in Venice, but I never lived there. I bought it a long time ago.
Yeah.
And then I never lived there. It was a rental property. I just sold it like a year ago.
Yeah?
Yeah. It was nice. It was great, but I never lived there.
So what are you reading now? Is it all sci-fi?
I'm reading a mystery novel right now, but I do read a lot of sci-fi.
Yeah.
That's the thing is I'm not doing a lot of heavy lifting. I'm not sitting around reading Dostoevsky and shit. I'm reading like old science fiction.
I'd like to reread Dostoevsky. That's the other dream. It's like I'm going to go back to Crime and Punishment. I can't and you get to a certain age, I can't even manage the names.
It takes, well, there's that too. I can't remember the names. And then I read much more slowly now too, which is good in a way.
I like to read nonfiction. That's what
I'm not good at reading nonfiction.
You're not?
No. Every now and then I'll hit a nonfiction thing, generally a biography. And if I get through it, I feel really accomplished. I'm like, wow, I got through that.
But, I did my homework.
I did. No, and it generally has to be kind of racy or something, because otherwise I get lost. But also the thing with nonfiction is I start going, I can't remember the dates. I can't remember the names. Yeah. But I've never been able to do that.
Yeah,
so I get very, it is like homework. I get very, very like, I got to remember the names. I got to remember the dates.
Yeah, yeah. I get so proud when I finish a book. Like I'll have it on the table for a long time. People come by like, well, how's that book? I finished it.
That's the same way. Very proud.
It's so ridiculous.
It's really stupid.
So let's where'd you grow up?
New Haven, Connecticut.
All right. So let's deal with this thing. Sally's or Frank Pepe's?
Oh, yeah, right. Okay, Pepe's. No. No, absolutely. Pepe's. Have you been there?
Yeah.
Have you been to those pizza places?
Yes.
Both of them?
Yep.
Now there's other ones,
No,
too.
I know, but you Pepe's. Grew up with it. But Pepe's. I didn't know about the phenomenon of it. And I went to school in Boston. I started my comedy career doing...
Yeah.
I know that drive from Boston to
Where
New York.
Where are you from?
Well, I grew up in New Mexico.
Okay.
My folks are from Jersey, so I always had a relationship. Yes. But I was in Boston for years.
Mm-hmm.
So I know that run from, Boston and New York and everything in between. And and I actually auditioned for Yale Drama School in the most ridiculous.
Really?
It was ridiculous.
Why?
Dude. Your dad was probably president at the time.
He might have been. When was it? Do you remember?
It was probably 86, 85, 86. Sure.
No, I don't think he was anymore then. But what if just,
I was like so cocky and so like, not prepared. And then I remember it very well because I was like, I'd gotten the audition. I'd done a little acting in college. Mm. And Derek Walcott.
Oh.
He was, I took a playwriting seminar with him.
Wow.
But I was bad at all this. And, and I remember I was like, I'm going to go audition for Yale Drama School.
Uh-huh.
And so and I had no idea about show business or about what it took. So for a headshot, I gave a photo booth, a strip of photo booth pictures.
That's great. Though.
Right. But, and then I needed a referral letter. So I was like, I got to get Derek to give me one. And the day before, I went over to his apartment on campus and I knocked on the door. I'm like, will you write me a referral for Yale? And he was in his bathrobe and this big Caribbean man. He's like, okay, come in. He stands up, he types it on a hand typewriter and sends me away with it. And
how the fuck did you not get in to someplace? Because that would have been, I would have taken you in a heartbeat.
Right. I thought the audacity.
Absolutely.
But they're not into audacity.
They're not but here's in some ways. I think you're right.
But here's what I realized. So I'm waiting to do the audition. There's a woman waiting, and she is deep into some like heavy, kind of like she's rehearsing with her hands like, whoa!
Yeah.
Whoa! Yeah. And she's doing movement.
Sure, Grotowski or whatever.
Yeah, whatever it was.
Stuff.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Some
or
kind
the,
of movement.
What
thing.
Was that Japanese
Buto.
Yeah, like that. It was like crazy. And I had that moment before I'm about to go in, not unlike an audition, I'm like, oh, I'm not getting this.
Oh, dear. I don't know, man. I would have taken. Do you remember what you did? Did you have to do monologues?
Yeah,
and
I picked some weird fucking, Greek for that. I didn't even do Shakespeare for the classic. It was some Greek thing. I'm mispronouncing things. And I did a Sam Shepard piece for the current one. I don't remember if it was Cowboy Mouth or something.
Excellent.
But I'm like, I decided that an action I would do, I would jerk off my belt.
Awesome. awesome.
And
oh, my God.
And they were just looking at me,
Paul. Had I been in charge, man, you would have absolutely been in.
They were looking at me, and it was like, it's one of those, you know, those moments when you're doing acting, auditioning or whatever, you know, and you're not in a production, but you're being judged by people.
Yes.
And they're right up there on the list of the most embarrassing moments of your fucking
couldn't
life.
Couldn't possibly be more embarrassing.
It was one of those.
No, the most naked, vulnerable, idiotic shit.
Yeah, and it was a long drive back to Boston.
Oh, God, I love that. I love hearing that. Yeah. I wish you'd gotten in.
You would have been great. You think? I might have learned how to do it.
You would have been fantastic.
It would have been good to have some context.
There was a guy in my class. Yeah. I went to the old drama school. There was a guy like that in my class.
Really?
He left after the first year.
Why?
He couldn't handle it? Yeah. No, he could handle it. Yeah. He couldn't handle him.
Yeah.
And it was like he just couldn't. He was great.
Yeah?
Great actor. And it's like, I think he still acts.
Yeah?
He was fantastic.
Yeah.
I loved him. And he was the best.
Well, there's always that guy.
He didn't give a shit.
Right.
He didn't give a shit.
There's always the guy that's like, you remember that guy? He was a genius. And no one knows what happened to him.
Totally.
Yeah. And it's
he was the first guy.
90% of the time, not a good story.
No, it's not. Probably not. But he was the first guy I can remember. This is, you know, what is this? The early 90s. First guy I can remember seeing walking around in his pajamas.
Yeah.
You know, wearing his pajama top out in public or wearing his pajama bottoms out in public. And I remember thinking, this is special.
This guy's got something.
This guy has definitely got something.
Like he's on his own time zone,
absolutely.
This guy.
He's a genius. He's a genius.
The pajama top genius.
Yes. He's a genius. And he really was a brilliant actor.
Of course. But if you're of a certain type of sensitivity... Yeah, and you come from a mild insanity yourself. Yeah. You're always going to think that lunatics are geniuses.
Geniuses.
But if you can't apply it,
no, it's not genius. I guess not. It really is that.
They're
thing
just special,
like,
man. They're
just
like
just special. They're really interesting.
Sure, yeah. I've followed a lot of those guys around.
You must have, right? I mean, well, just there must be
you
so
know
many
them
of those guys.
Yeah, in comedy do. And in life. I remember one time when I was a kid.
Comedy seems to be just chock-a-block with guys like that.
Well, sure. We're you know, kind of asocial.
Yeah.
You know,
And that's a definite indication that you got something special going on.
Of course.
If you're completely asocial.
Yeah, because you can't fit into the normal expectations of life.
No.
And then you just decide to do this job where you wander around from town to town, staying in shitty hotels and... talking to strangers. It's not what it used to be. But I remember when I was in high school, I got obsessed with this guy where I worked at a restaurant across from the university. And there was a schizophrenic guy who used to sit there. Mm-hmm. And he wore these lace-up boots to his fucking knees and shorts and a denim vest. And he would smoke Winchesters. And he would draw pictures that made no sense. And I'm like, no one knows, but this guy.
Guy's a fucking genius.
He's onto something.
He's totally onto
something.
And
I brought him to my house. I took him on like a stray animal.
Risky.
My mom knew him. You know, like...
Did you find out his story? Was it like he was like, this guy was a minister at one time
I think what it was, and this has happened to me before in terms of like trying to get backstory, I figured out his name. Mm-hmm. And I think he was like living in an abandoned house.
Yeah.
And I figured out that he was from Jersey or somewhere. Uh-huh. And he used to draw pictures of guns and he'd write a lot of things that didn't make sense. And it was art. It looked like outsider art.
Yeah. Yeah.
And his name was Pete Newhart. And I tracked down his family.
Holy shit.
And he was just what it usually is the family's like, yes, we know.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Nothing you know, we did everything
he's
we could.
He's been gone for years. No, totally. Totally. Yeah. Yale, New Haven was filled with fascinating people like this. Well, I think universities attract.
And you grew up you grew up the whole time in New Haven when your dad was a professor.
Yeah,
first?
I was a professor for years. Yeah, so I grew up in New Haven. Yeah,
and like they were just around. They gravitate to the university.
I think they do.
Yeah,
you know what I mean. And they're at the university too.
Yeah,
there's all the kind of eternal, perpetual grad student guys.
Yeah.
And women who are kind of there forever.
Yeah.
And they're fucking weird.
Yeah.
And they're hanging around the coffee shops.
Yeah.
And they've got stacks of books and they've been there forever and they're never
going to
leave.
Yeah,
And they're like, you know, so, and they're almost the same thing.
Sure.
And it's very much this kind of like,
marginal genius thing
right.
of some guy who's up there studying Mesopotamian poetry
and
he's never going to fucking do anything that.
Yeah. Cracking the cuneiform code.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. Cracking the Mayan hieroglyphs.
Yeah, yeah.
And who the fuck knows where he's from
yeah.
and where he's, you know, yeah. and he's just found this place yeah. and that's where he's landed and he's never going to leave.
I know. But,
and that's what I feel like in my apartment.
Yeah, yeah. but you're not.
I don't know. I'm worried I am.
But that's, you know, the weird thing is, I think that certain type of people, and I'm one of them, you're jealous of those guys.
Mm-hmm. That's the fucked up thing.
I know.
I'm really envious, and there's a strange desire to be one of those
guys. Yeah.
No,
that
totally.
Guy doesn't give a fuck.
He doesn't give a fuck. And he's off on his own stupid, weird thing.
Yeah, yeah.
And he's studying the Babylonian shit.
Yeah.
He's doing the most marginal fucking thing possible.
Yeah.
And that's awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, the thing we don't see is when they're at home going like, what am I doing?
Totally. Totally. But I think in my imagination, they don't have that moment.
They never do that.
I think in my mind, they never have that moment.
Yeah. And they're always the weirdo.
They're always, they're happy to be the weirdo. They're happy to be the marginal genius nobody listens to and nobody pays any attention to.
Yeah, yeah.
But I don't think that's true.
No. They're all mentally ill, Paul. And there's just no room in the hospital for them.
No, there really isn't. No, they found a different hospital.
Sure, yeah. But, like, I know that whole vibe that, you know, that coffee shop scene, the big work. Like, because I was in Boston for years and Harvard Square have that.
Absolutely.
You know, there were just those places where.
Totally.
But for me,
my friend used to call it the off-campus housing guys.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? The dudes who are, you know, you're living off campus and there's some guy down the hallway who's some weird guy.
Sure.
And like,
who's
been
in the house for 30 years.
Totally.
And he's watched several different crews
totally.
Of undergrads and grads.
And every now and then, he left me a pot of beans outside my door. What the fuck? Yeah, the guy down the hall. You know, it's just weird.
Yeah. What is
he's
he
got a monkey, I think, in there. You know what I mean? It's just like, what is going on?
Yep. There was I lived in a house like that.
Yes.
In Somerville.
Yes. Everybody. Yeah, I did too in New Haven.
Oh, I don't know. Do they exist still?
I wonder.
I think we were the last generation.
But that's interesting. Why doesn't it exist anymore? Where's it gone?
Well,
because
I think
you're right. It doesn't really happen so much anymore.
Because I think we were tethered to the sort of end of a wave that was connected to some intellectual, artistic tradition that we still aspire to. And I think once everything became fragmented and more self-centered and decontextualized because of the internet, that you don't feel that legacy anymore.
That's interesting.
I sounded like one of those books. Well,
fucking amazing, dude. You really took that.
Did that make sense?
It did, actually. Yeah. And it's interesting, that thing of like subcultures are gone. I mean, it's obvious, I guess, but it's like they just disappeared with the internet.
Now, I think so.
Everything's subculture.
Yeah.
Everything you can.
Well, it's small.
It's overculture. Now,
yeah. Everybody can find their own little cranny in the mediated world.
Yeah.
There was something about lack of mediation, I think, that helped things.
Yes.
You know, I remember reading those books or taking that class about, you know, mediation and, you know, lenses and how most of what we take in is not really reality, like one of those. And, and now
frames of reference.
Really
and
true,
stuff.
Dude.
Yeah, it is. It seems like it, yeah.
So when you're growing up, we established Pepe's.
Yes.
And that was it for you. No clam pie at Sally's?
No, Sally's was not. I don't know why, but my father wouldn't go there. He wouldn't set foot in there. My grandfather was settled in New Haven when they came from Italy.
Okay.
So my grandfather had already grown up there going to Pepe's. So
it was a family institution.
I think so. Yeah.
I didn't know anything about this New Haven pizza shit until like a few years ago.
Oh, really?
And there's a guy named Dean Falzone who, like, you know, he's got a brother-in-law or something that, you know, wrote a book about it. He made a movie about New Haven pizza.
It's a thing. Yeah.
No, I know it's a thing, but
it's
very
thing.
Specific.
Very specific.
It's not nationwide. It's like a coded thing. Like, it's only people who know New Haven. It's not like Chicago pizza versus New York pizza.
No.
When you bring up New Haven, they're like, what are you talking about?
Yeah.
They don't make it anywhere else.
They really don't, though. I've never had any pizza like it anywhere else in the world, even.
Is
not
it
even
great,
in
though?
Italy. I think it's great.
Yeah.
But, like, my son, I took my son to have it, and he was sort of lukewarm about it.
Yeah, well,
he was not impressed.
Yeah, because it didn't make sense.
No.
It doesn't
make this is weird.
Yeah, where's the sauce?
It's too burned.
Too burned.
It's too chewy and too burned. And it was like,
it's an acquired taste, kid.
It was, and I had to keep saying no. But I keep insisting this is really the, I mean, and for me it is. So.
Yeah.
Nothing compares to it.
But what, because the times I've gone to New Haven a couple times, I play at that. What's that theater there? Is this not the State Theater? It's a little theater.
Not the Schubert.
No, it's like it's right across from the place that makes the horrible burgers with the press. You know that
Louis Lunch.
Yeah,
where they claim to have invented the hamburger,
the cheeseburger with the machine
with the nasty blackened crusty things with the upright, the vertical grills.
Yeah, the vertical grills. Yeah,
so the fat drips out nicely. Yeah, so, you know, so it's nice and.
But
it's
like right across from that the theater, and I can't.
Yeah,
remember
I know what you mean. I can't remember what it's called. Yeah,
but so I go back and I'm there, and I go to the museum, and I'm on the Yale campus a little bit.
The art museum
is great.
You ever been to the Natural History Museum,
no.
The Peabody Museum. You should next time you're in New Haven.
Yeah.
Go to the Peabody Museum.
I stay at that pretty hotel that's sort of a library-themed thing. Yeah, yeah.
No, I can tell you there was never anything like that. It's weird when I see that hotel. It looks like a hotel from Santa Monica.
Yeah, like it landed.
Yeah. It's like, and when I see that in New Haven, which was really a dumpy city.
It was. Well, terrible. That's the question, because you go back, was it, when you were growing up, was the Italian neighborhood still intact?
Pretty Italian.
Oh,
yeah.
Really?
That's where my grandfather grew up, yeah.
So you would go over to your grandfather's?
No. At that point, they lived up in Massachusetts. My dad was born in Boston and lived in that area, Massachusetts.
All right.
And so, I still had relatives in New Haven.
Yeah.
Italian relatives.
Now?
Yeah, probably. Yeah, I don't see him. I don't see him anymore.
Yeah.
But there's definitely a lot of Italians.
Both,
there.
But your mom's not Italian?
No.
Oh.
No. She was from New Jersey. She was from Plainfield.
Jersey. All right.
She was from Jersey Shore and then Plainfield.
I got Jersey Shore people.
Do you?
Yeah, I think that's where my father's family landed. So what? So when you're growing up, you got how many siblings?
I had two. Now I just have one.
Yeah.
My sister died in June.
I'm sorry. That's
all right.
Yeah. You got the brother.
I have a brother.
Who's the actor?
Who is also an actor.
How's that going with you two?
It seems to be going okay. He teaches it now, too.
Good for him.
He teaches at Temple.
Yeah, it's right.
He teaches at Temple.
Good for him.
Yeah.
It's almost like when, you know, somebody, you know, kind of breaks away from the dream.
Yeah.
You're like, congratulations. You know, and you did it.
You actually, listen, absolutely. And he's in, and he's out there at Temple. He still acts, but now he teaches, and I think he's a good, really good teacher.
And he's happy?
I think he's happy.
That's such good news. When I see somebody in comedy who I haven't seen in a while, and they're like, oh, yeah, I got out a long time ago, and I'm doing this, and I'm like, oh, good for you.
Good
congratulations.
For you. I feel the same way. Good for you.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Because, I feel the same way.
I think when you're in it long enough, even with the career that you have, you know that it's like one job to the next.
Absolutely. Chain-smoking jobs. Oh. Just chain-smoking. Doing several jobs at once.
Well, you work all the time.
I used to do that.
What?
Like, I do two or three jobs at the same time.
Like acting jobs?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
I do two movies or something.
Yeah.
It was stupid.
Just because of panic?
Yes. Absolutely. Completely because of panic. I was like, I can't. I'm going to—it's a shark thing. If I stop moving, I'm going to die.
They're going to forget.
Everybody's going to forget.
Oh,
so I would do multiple things at once.
So your dad was an English professor?
He was a comparative literature professor. So it was English and Italian stuff.
Huh. And you grew up in that? The weight of it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I liked it, though. Because,
yeah.
Again, it's like I liked the libraries and all that stuff.
It's such a nice way to grow up.
It's a really nice way to grow up.
Because it feels important.
Yeah. It feels so – it's also very cozy.
Yeah.
It's cozy. It's leather armchairs and lamps.
And if there's ever a disruption, you're like, who let them in?
Yeah, totally. And people's pipe smoke. Smell people's – my father's colleagues, the pipe smoke. It's cozy.
Oh, yeah.
But that's deceptive because it's a fucking shark tank.
It's a shark tank. And also, it turns out a lot of it is just a big racket.
Mm-hmm.
The college
also
racket.
Also a huge racket.
Yeah.
Yep. Also a huge racket.
But you decided not to go into arts and letters. You went into acting. How's that? But were you seeing productions at Yale? What inspired you to do it?
Yeah. I mean, there was stuff at the Yale Rep, and there were other theaters. There was the place called the Long Wharf Theater, which was like a regional theater. Yeah. My parents, you know, it's a university, so it's an artsy.
Yeah.
It's an artsy environment.
Yeah.
So it's like, and my mom was really into taking us to plays, and my dad too, and movies and stuff. So it was a lot of that.
It's so, I feel like I'm just barely a boomer, and you're sort of the next one.
Yeah.
But like, there's this like this area there where we, you know, where it was the last sort of, you know, gasp of that type of culture where we were actually part of that first generation revival movie house stuff. That,
yes.
You know, all that stuff that happened.
Big, very much so.
In the 30s, 40s, and 50s was being, you know, kind of assessed.
Yeah.
And,
And coming back and you're absorbing all of that stuff. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
And like, it's coming back now a little bit. Like, there's like in this town, there's revival houses again.
Yeah.
American Cinematheque is doing a thing.
Really?
Yeah.
Is it like the silent movie theater thing still? Does that place still exist?
It's a movie theater, but it's no longer the silent movie theater.
It's not just silent
movies. It doesn't go that far back, you know, but, you know, Tarantino's got his theater.
Right, yeah.
When it's not running, you know, weird grindhouse things that, you know, nine people want to see, they've got...
Some like Singaporean like
bloodfest,
exactly. Cannibalism movie.
But like I went over there and I saw you know, the In-Laws recently, and
great.
Like, they let me. And I went to American Cinematheque. They let me host a screening, and I chose Dog Day.
Yeah.
And they found a perfect print of it.
Oh,
it
amazing.
Was, when was the last time you watched that movie?
I haven't seen that in a while.
Holy
shit. I would like, you know, I saw last night, I saw Blue Velvet was on TV.
I saw that at Tarantino's place.
Oh my God, that movie is perfect, almost perfect.
When was the last time you saw it?
I don't think I'd seen it in maybe 15 years.
Right, I think I saw it when it came out, and I'm seeing
I saw it when it came out, and then I think I saw it again, and this was maybe the third time ever. I mean, it was a movie when I first saw it, I thought it was amazing. But,
I did too, but I didn't realize that there was actually a story.
Yeah, that's actually, that's really funny you say that.
Yeah.
Because the last time I saw it and this time I saw it, I was like, oh, there's like a real kind of like pulpy noir story going on.
Didn't notice it.
Completely didn't get it the first time. No, not at all. And actually, it's kind of great. And I was like, oh, it's like one of those noir movies.
Exactly.
I didn't really get that.
Yeah, because we were overwhelmed with the Lynchian thing.
Yes. And Dennis Hopper.
Yeah, that was the whole thing when I was
younger.
He's
not even in it that much, which I also realized now, too.
I couldn't believe that there was a story. And it happened.
I couldn't believe it either. And there's a real story.
Totally.
Yeah, genuinely a story.
That's what it is about something.
I know.
It's not just about like
the
that
whole drug
weird.
Deal, yes.
Yeah.
But that's an interesting thing to me is that as I get older, like the stuff that struck me as weird when I was younger no longer seems as weird. Now it seems, and I don't know whether that's age, but now it just seems normal to me.
Well, no, because I think
like
when
things that seem so surreal and strange, and now I look at it and I look at that movie now. It was so strange then. Now I look at it and I go,
right.
It seems like realism to me.
Well, but I think there's also the fact that when we're younger and we're aspiring to be, you know, either intellectual or an art or a, you know, a film guy
you're wide
open.
Yeah.
But you're just wide open and you don't even know how to assess things.
That's true.
Right?
Yes. And you're looking for, I was looking for weirdness.
Sure.
Weirdness was going to be more, as like, we've talked about, the marginal fucking guys.
We were trying to become the marginal guy.
Yes.
There's got to be a path.
To be a training. You got to train yourself to be the marginal guy. That's right, though.
I had the same experience with Paris, Texas, which I saw when it came out, and I had no idea what it was about.
No, but a lot of things are like that. I remember making myself watch the movie Solaris. You ever seen that? That Russian?
The original one? Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Making myself watch it. And it was it felt like it was 17 hours long.
Yeah.
It was just brutal.
I don't even know.
I felt like I'd been beaten up afterwards.
And they remade that, didn't they, with Clooney?
Yeah. I've never seen that.
Either.
But then I saw it again not that long ago. I'm like, oh, yeah, there's a story. It's actually pretty coherent. It's not that. And you're kind of like, okay, all right, it's weird, but it's not. But I just remember it being this mad fucking thing. But you're right. Your brain is not formed.
I think that's it.
No, your brain really literally isn't formed still.
Yeah.
My son is 22 years old. I'm like, his brain's still not formed.
You're just taking stuff in.
Yeah.
Still, do you have any of your movies that you like look at and you're like, oh my God, what was that?
Probably. I don't know. I don't watch a whole lot of them. I did this kids movie that's probably the weirdest thing.
Really?
Yeah, I did this movie called Big Fat Liar.
Yeah.
That's like kids, generations,
I kinda remember that.
Generations of people have seen this thing.
Yeah.
It's just bizarre.
Yeah.
I mean, it's really strange.
Yeah. Well, maybe that's going to be one of those movies when these kids grow up, like, I had no idea what that was about.
Totally. That would be amazing if that was their fucking, if that was their Paris, Texas. And their Blue Velvet. I'd love that, actually. That would be great. I've never even thought that that's going into people's kids' heads, and it might be the same thing. I never thought about that.
Yeah.
That is fucking some bizarre thing that's going to haunt a kid.
Yeah.
I know, but I never really think of that.
I was recently exploring the fact that my grandparents accidentally took me and my brother, when they were visiting us in New Mexico, to see Deliverance, not knowing what it was, like when it came out.
Sure.
And the weird thing about that, though, Paul, was that, like, I remember the rape scene, but all I remember was there was a man in his underwear, you know, and they're right, making him make noises.
Yeah, right.
That's all I remember. Sure. And then I watched it again recently, and I'm like, holy fuck.
Holy shit.
They really raped that guy.
That movie's terrifying.
But my child brain didn't register it.
No, you didn't get it.
Exactly.
No, you just didn't get it.
It's the same with Blue Velvet.
My mother did Blue Velvet. My mother did that stuff, took us through, like, wildly inappropriate things like that. I'm glad, because it went in, you know what I mean? Like, I absorbed it. And that's cool, because something went in there in an interesting way. But I didn't know what the fuck was going on.
Yeah.
I remember seeing The Conversation.
Yeah, that's a hard
movie. And it was terrifying to me. It was just scary. Yeah. I was like, I don't know what's going on. I have no idea what's going on.
That guy's just taking apart his entire house.
I don't know what's going on. But it terrified me.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I absorbed the menace of it.
Because of the obsession of it.
I got the menace of it.
Right, right, right.
Nothing else.
And that's a very, like, mental menace.
Yeah. Yeah, you feel the menace of it even as a little kid.
So, you go to Yale undergrad?
Yeah.
And you study what?
I studied English. I ended up studying English.
Did you take your dad's class?
No, he was not there anymore.
Oh, he wasn't?
No. No, he'd left. He'd left by then.
Where'd he go?
He sort of didn't do anything for a little while.
Was that a weird time? Yale.
Probably for him it was, yeah.
Were your parents together?
Yes, they were. Yes. Yes, they were together. I guess. I don't know. Sometimes I'm like, probably would have been better not to.
Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, he took a couple of, maybe a year or two before he,
became the baseball commissioner?
Before he went into baseball.
But he was the president of Yale.
He was.
For years?
No, not for that long. I think most of those guys stay in that job for years.
Yeah.
I don't think he liked doing it.
It's hard to be a bureaucrat in academia.
Yeah.
My buddy's
not fun, I don't think.
He's a writer. He's a teacher at Columbia, and he's a brilliant guy.
Yeah.
Sam Lipsight. Yeah. Uh-huh. And but like when you hear about what it takes to be like a tenured guy and just to deal with school stuff.
Like I said, it's a shark tank. And it's like, I don't think I think he thought that was going to be maybe more enjoyable than it was, and it wasn't.
Yeah, because you're a manager.
You're a manager at the best. And it's like you're just you're raising money the whole time.
So when you did undergrad, did you learn anything? What was your focus?
I guess like American, sort of 19th century American stuff, like Poe and Melville.
Oh, really?
Which was stuff I liked to read. So that was
easier. I was a romantic literature. I was my focus undergrad, but both semesters of the focus, it was at 9 a.m.
Yeah.
And it was tough Jesus going, Christ. Dude.
And so you mean like reading like
Shelley,
Byron Yates, and stuff?
Byron, yeah.
I can't read poetry. It makes no sense.
And I was cramming it.
My
and
brain
like,
is not.
I'm not, I think I might still have an incomplete.
I'm pretty sure I probably do.
It was, I think, it was a paper on Blake.
Oh.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. Well, that stuff actually I can read. That's sort of, some of that makes sense.
But, it's very simple language, but then there are the drawings, and then there's, just
some
books upon books of analysis. And I'm like, what are they seeing?
I know. Why are you? Well, that's a whole other thing is the critical shit I couldn't read. No. So it was good because I was reading like Edgar Allan Poe. I'm reading like horror stories.
Yeah,
so that was good.
Yeah. But then you get done with that and you decide, like, I don't want to teach?
I think the thing that I did, I don't know that I learned much about it, but I did a lot of extracurricular theater undergraduate.
Yeah.
That's really what I ended
up doing.
So,
like, the non-theater school theater company.
Yeah. So, that's what,
like, what
whatever.
Plays you do?
Whatever. You would do...
I did Indian Wants a Bronc.
That kind of thing a lot. Yeah, like I did, people did Hurley Burley and stuff like that a lot. I didn't
Zoo
do that.
Story.
We did Zoo Story. We did Glengarry Glen Ross.
Oh, that's bold.
Yeah, that was bold because I think they didn't have the rights to it.
Oh, right.
When we did it, so
nothing
I think
like
did.
A bunch of 19-year-olds doing Glengarry.
Don't like sitting around in trench coats trying to be like old Jews from Chicago. No, totally powder, the white powder in your hair, the whole thing. Fantastic, though. Fantastic. I mean, so great that we had the fucking solid, balls man. To do it.
Everyone's parents loved it.
Absolutely. And who knows? Maybe it was good. Maybe it was good.
I think people can suspend
just
disbelief.
Maybe it was good. But stuff like that. And so, whatever. Just
but you
all
took
kinds
to
of
it.
Stuff.
You were like, oh, yeah.
Well, I really enjoyed doing that. So I think probably if I don't know if I learned anything, but that's what I did.
Yeah.
You know, mostly.
Without any acting training at all.
No.
You were just doing it.
Yeah.
When you got into Yale Drama School, you did the audition, right?
I did do the audition, yeah.
Do you remember what pieces you did?
I did the Shakespeare thing I did was Richard II.
He's the Hunchback?
No, that's Richard III.
Oh, sorry. I saw.
I should have just done a Hunchback for him anyway. But
I saw William Hurt do that on Broadway, and the effort he put into the Hunchback, it was so distracting. I couldn't.
Right. Yeah. Well, I get a little distracted by. I'll tell you, I was in Sweden once.
Yeah.
I was in Stockholm.
Yeah.
I like the way you were like. Yeah. You were in Sweden. I was in
Where's
Sweden.
This going?
I know. You were just like. I saw and I walked by a theater and they were doing Richard III. It was in Swedish and I went in and watched and it was great.
Yeah.
Because it was all in Swedish, but the guy who played Richard III did nothing. He didn't do any of that stuff.
Yeah.
He didn't have a hand. He didn't have a limp. He didn't have a hunchback. He did nothing. He just was weird.
Yeah.
And I was like, that was the best I've ever seen it
done.
Took
the easy path.
Well, no. I actually think it was the harder path. Yeah. I think the easier thing is to be all like, you know.
But you got
to
stay in that.
Yeah, it's true. You do. But it's kind of the easier thing. Because as long as you have some weird thing you're doing, everybody's going to pay attention.
He played Richard with a tick. It was just like a minor tick.
He did. Towards the end, he started having a weird tick.
Oh.
But it was actually very effective.
Yeah. Are you good with Shakespeare?
I mean, I got all the training in it and stuff. I've hardly ever done any.
Yeah.
I played Hamlet.
You did Hamlet.
I did Hamlet like 10 years ago. I was too old to do it.
Yeah.
But
that's always a good choice to, you know.
To be too old?
Yeah, to be too old to do Hamlet. I just got to get this out of the way.
Yeah, totally. Somebody, the guy had asked me to do it when I was younger, and I didn't do it. I should have, but I didn't. I did it when I was too old. But it was fun, but I hadn't done any Shakespeare. I don't know if I'm any good at it.
Was it a revelation? Did you connect with it?
Yes, I suppose I did. Yeah, I mean, I didn't know the play actually that well, and I'd never seen it before.
I'm not good with Shakespeare.
Neither am I. I can't understand it.
I take it. If poetry's tricky, that's gonna,
exactly.
No, it's like I get lost at the language, and I've talked about it a lot, and I've had Ian McKellen.
Yeah.
Sir Ian McKellen, sit where you're sitting and do it to my face.
And you can't understand.
No, I got it then.
Oh, you did?
Well, he picked a good part.
He made it clear.
Yeah. But it was just a simple thing. It was an interesting, it had a point and, but it didn't, you know, make me.
I still don't, even when those amazing people do it. It's great to hear their voices. They have beautiful voices.
Yeah.
So you pay attention, but I still can't follow it.
All right. So you go to Yale now, like that's hard, right?
Yeah, it is. Yeah. It's like, it's nonstop and it's intense and there's a lot of physical training stuff that's hard. And,
yeah.
You know, yeah, it's nonstop, but it's good. You're acting all the time and that's great. You know?
But you learn things?
Yeah. I mean, I think you do just by repetition. Yeah. It's sort of like you just get a lot of experience.
Yeah. Was there anybody in your group, your crew? That we know?
There was a guy named Lance Reddick who was in my class who was on The Wire.
Oh, yeah.
He was a terrific actor. He passed away at the beginning of the year.
Oh.
But he was great.
Yeah.
And I think he's the guy who did a lot in a lot of things.
Now, do you cite Yale as the place that, I mean, do you go back? Do they have you come back and do?
No. No. They'll go back and hold a seminar, a master class and stuff like
something
that.
Like no. They give you an award or anything?
They gave me a degree this year.
Yeah.
The university did. Yeah.
Oh, they did?
They did. They gave me an honorary degree. I have no idea why. It was very nice of them.
Did you go dressed up in the...
I had to wear the robe.
In the gown?
The whole thing, yeah. The hat, the floppy hat.
Did you do a little speech?
Velvety hat. Oh, I didn't have to do a speech, thank
no?
God.
You didn't do a presentation?
No, I'm terrified of having to give... Like public speaking is
really?
The worst.
No shit.
I hate it.
What happens?
Freeze up. I freeze up. I really do. I freeze up and I start saying shit that makes no sense. And I'll probably start swearing.
That's good.
Yeah.
I would expect you to yell.
No, I don't know. I think I get very quiet. I get really cowed. I'm not good. I can't speak off the cuff publicly.
Oh.
No. I mean, I guess I'd have to prepare a speech, but then that's not going to work either. I don't like speaking in public speaking.
So you just don't do it.
No. I'm the guy, I don't want to give a toast at a wedding. I can't stand it.
So like if you're in a group situation and you kind of feel it coming.
Oh! That's fucking terrifying. It's the worst.
You're just waiting for Paul.
Oh God. No, please don't. And those kinds of things when it's like, it used to be, you know, you're at a play. It's like a magic show and somebody's going to ask you up on stage. Oh, nothing God. Would be a bigger fucking nightmare than to be asked up on stage.
Oh, it's
like
the worst.
The worst.
Well, that's funny because I get that too. And like, and because I'm a I remember like I went back.
Yeah, but you must be. I mean, you know.
I don't like, I do a very specific thing.
Yeah.
And I've grown over the years to know that, you know, I'm not the guy. It's like, hey, we're having a few, you know, we're honoring this person. You think you could do it? Like,
exactly.
No, I can't. It's all very, I do a very selfish thing.
Yes, you're right. And it's like, I don't know how to do that. Don't ask me to come and give a heartfelt speech about somebody. I don't know.
You have Jeff Ross do it.
But then
you
know, I also feel like it's private. I don't want, if it's somebody I know, it's also like I don't want to get up there and it's private.
But what is it that I mean, because it seems like you feel the same thing I do. It's like for some reason, no matter how many years I've done what I do, and I've got different I have a spectrum of ways I can do it. I can be aggressive. I can, you know, take control and everything. But that sort of thing where it's not the context for what I do.
No.
And I'm asked to do it, like I literally become my entire sense of self collapses,
and I don't know, and then I run, I like Rolodex through who am I supposed to be?
Who
do I be? How do I do this? Like, what do I do? What's
because,
the right behavior?
Because I know
this?
Mimi will just really wants to cry.
But that's totally. Or start yelling. Yeah, just fucking yell at people talk about. That's really weird, though. I realized something recently that was really, really chilling. And part of it was my sister once said to me, she saw me on a talk show doing something, and she was like, you know, she was a very intense person, very smart, and she was like, you are full of shit on that thing. I saw you and everything coming out of your mouth is just a lie. You seemed so, and I thought, I was doing really well on that, wasn't I? And it's like, no, and I watch myself sometimes on a talk show and I go, I don't believe that guy at all. And then I'll see myself in a movie and I'll go, oh, I believe that.
You do.
That's weird.
Yeah.
That's not right. I shouldn't believe myself playing a character more than I believe myself just being me. That's weird.
Yeah, but you're not just being you. It's heightened.
Yeah.
And there's an expectation.
Yeah.
And you've talked to a segment producer.
Yeah.
And they've convinced you that the story that you have
is really great. It's gonna land huge. Yeah. And you're just like, it's so unnatural.
Yeah, so it's not you.
It's really not you. You're right.
If you go out there as you.
But
you,
I should be more convincing as me, shouldn't I? Than as a character.
No, because but you are convincing as you. We're having a nice conversation. Now,
feels less like that, though.
Well, there's not 500 people sitting here and a guy.
And I don't know what we're going to say.
Yeah.
And that's actually part of it, too. I don't know what we're going to talk about.
Well, you can't just go do that on television.
But people, there are people who are really good at that.
Few.
Though.
There are people that can do panel well, but it's just because they know how to tell the joke or land the story. But no one's going up there like the old. If you watch fucking old Dick Cavett shows, the amount of dead air.
Oh, my God.
It's ridiculous.
Actually, you watch that, and it's kind of shocking how not great it is.
Oh, it's the worst. Or
and
old
Dick
Carson.
Dick Cavett's just terrible. Dick Cavett's really, I mean, God bless him. I mean, it's amazing what he does. But it's really awkward.
Oh, it's
and weird
like takes forever. Like, even some of the old Carsons when it was an hour and a half.
Yeah.
Just like this dead air and. Jokes not landing.
And just spinning your wheels for a while.
Yeah.
And
that's
like,
what it looks like.
Yeah.
So like they've kind of refined it.
You're right.
And they have expectations. There was a time, Paul, where you could go on stage and just be like, I don't really know what's
really
going on.
And kind of bomb. And you're right, though.
And it was enough.
That's really interesting, though. You're right. Yeah. And they've refined it to such a degree that people can't sort of like spin their wheels and bomb anymore.
Well,
like
I can. I've done it a lot. I have a whole reel of panel appearances.
But this is before they've refined it. Maybe.
No, it was just that.
No.
Like, Well, no, there was a period there where I lived in New York, and if Conan got stuck for a guest, I'd usually have enough things in the hopper
that they just like, call you up. And
yeah, like because I was a panel guest, and I used to do sit down comedy, but I'd go out there with shit that wasn't quite prepared, and then it became this dynamic that I didn't plan.
Right.
Like I would go on to Conan, and I would say something, and it would tank, and then I would get mad at the audience, and Conan would be like, "This is Mark," and I'm like, "It's not Mark. I didn't want that to be me." And it became a thing.
Yes, right. Then it becomes a thing.
Flailing.
Right. Then it becomes a thing.
But now I feel better about it because just recently I've been able to let that go because I watch Rickles on Carson.
I watch Rickles on Carson a lot.
But dude, like 90% of it, he's just like he's drowning the second he gets out there.
But that becomes funny.
That's right. And half of it doesn't even make sense.
He's fascinating because a lot of it doesn't make sense. Yeah. Some of the funniest shit he says. Yeah. Some of the funniest shit he says makes absolutely no sense.
Here he goes with the hat and the ear. And you're like, what?
You're did like, you, what does that
but
mean?
It's so, it doesn't,
but it's really funny.
I know. So, okay, but... So, like, when you get out of Yale, do you feel ready to go? You understand show business?
When I get out of Yale drama school?
Yeah.
But, you know, I took about 2.5 years between undergraduate and graduate school where I lived in Seattle. And I managed after a little bit of time to make a very small living as an actor.
In Seattle.
At that time, Seattle was the number one city in America. They were making all these movies and TV shows. I didn't work at any of the regional theaters. Yeah. I worked at these little, there were a million little black box experimental things.
So were you doing new playwright stuff?
Yes. A lot of shit like that and stuff like that. And then doing like industrial films for Boeing.
Oh, yeah. Well,
and stuff like that.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
then getting a day on a TV movie, a Linda Evans TV movie kind of thing, and having a day of that. And so managing to actually, I kind of had experience of actually being in the world trying to find acting.
But that's funny because, you know, by doing that, you were able to hide the thing that most actors do in New York in front of everybody.
What do you mean? Like
the black box theater thing.
Yes,
you
know, like totally.
You didn't have to start a theater troupe or, you know, get naked on, you know, Avenue
A. A lot of nudity.
But you were doing that
I did that in New York too, though, actually.
Oh, you did?
No, perfectly happy with that, though. Very proud of the being nudity? Nude on things. Yeah, absolutely.
In New York? Nude in New York. Was that the name of the show?
Yeah, well, it should have been. I can't remember the name of the thing. I did it at La Mama. I was at La Mama
good.
Where
yeah,
you got to get
a lot of nudity.
A lot of nudity.
Yeah.
It's required that you get naked at some point. So, yeah. So I had done
3 years in
you're
Seattle.
Right. I'd done about 3 years. Yeah.
That's where that's where you probably built a certain amount of confidence, anyways.
I think so.
Applying the
I think
the,
so.
The
so
the
that
skill set.
When I went to drama school, I was kind of the only person that had actually been out in the world trying to do stuff.
Oh, so, see, that's why. You know, when you got there.
And then I decided I really need to hone my chops.
Now. Yeah, yeah,
yep.
yeah. Put so my clothes on and hone my chops.
Yes, yeah, exactly. So I need to go back to school.
And then how soon do you start working after?
I started working pretty soon afterwards, doing regional theater stuff. Going out to San Diego.
Yeah.
Yeah, doing stage stuff was what I thought I was going to do. But I started working pretty
consistently.
Regional
theater.
Theater.
How was that, looking at that audience?
Kind of great.
Was it?
You can hear the hiss of the oxygen tanks. Just the you can hear the lady
challenge of theater, dude. When I talked I've talked to Annie Baker and what's that guy, Stephen Karam, is that his name?
Yeah, yeah.
And just like the nature of theater, even when you're doing bold new stuff, it's still like, they come.
And in those situations, it's tough. But, you know, they get loyal audiences in those places, so it's nice. They show up. Did you ever do any kind of theater like that?
Not really. I did some plays in college, but I never... The pursuing the acting thing was just too much for me, and I always wanted to be a comic. And I think for years I didn't even have, you know, representation as an actor.
Uh-huh.
You know, like I think I had a pretty powerful manager that tried his best, and he would get favors occasionally from agents. Just, you know, send Mark out on something and see if it sticks. And I'd do one audition, and then they'd abandon me.
Uh-huh.
It didn't really come around until recently. Uh-huh. I'm trying to get the hang of it.
Okay. Yeah.
I do all right. But, like, I still don't feel like, you know, I was so in it.
Yeah.
You do.
I do, yeah. But I don't do the, like, methody thing, but I can feel like I'm in it. Yeah, definitely.
But, like, in terms
and of... accents can make me feel like I'm more in it. Yeah.
Because I rewatched, you know, I don't know, I watched a new movie. I watched The Holdovers. I watched Sideways at least twice a year.
Really?
Yeah. I can't.
God,
I just,
you like it. Good.
I can't. I have to watch it.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. But, you know, it's interesting. With The Holdovers, I actually... was started out before I didn't ever do it on film, but I was like, maybe this guy should have some kind of old school New England-y thing. And I did that for a while when we were rehearsing.
Yeah.
And it was like, nah, I don't need to do this. But I'm glad I did it because I actually think it helped
in the way I played the guy.
Yeah, it actually helped.
And I imagine that your childhood probably helped as well.
Yes. For sure.
In terms of like knowing that world.
Yes. All those people.
And the sort of weird kind of you know, self-importance crumbles throughout the movie.
Totally. That kind of self-importance. But I think that kind of self-importance in general is really funny. I find that kind of thing very funny.
Especially when it's so fragile.
Yes. And it is.
It's super
fragile with guys like that. You know, and because it's all based just on this kind of like high intellect. And then that intellect only alienates you more and doesn't hold up really outside of that narrow world that you're in.
And that was the confines of that character in the movie.
Yes.
It wasn't a choice.
No, that's what the guy's going through.
He lived there.
Yeah, that's the whole thing. Yeah. Well, he's come to rest at this place. It's the only place he feels safe. He's marginal.
Yeah.
He's one of these marginal people.
Yeah,
but then it doesn't support him anywhere else but that place.
Yeah, so, and when he gets out in the world.
Or with anybody, if he's then forced to have to sit with two other people alone for 2 weeks, then it falls apart because it doesn't really, it doesn't work.
Yeah, yeah, and it's like, but these characters, some of the characters you do, you know, I don't know all of them, but there is that element, you know, I don't think in John Adams, but there...
Well, no, what element of...
Well, the real comedy heart of it is the sort of abrasiveness of the confidence that is so, you know,
misguided and it just doesn't it doesn't land
and
right.
When it crumbles, it's like the best.
Yes, I agree. I think it's true of John Adams.
You do.
It's not necessarily funny, but it's the same thing.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a guy who's just so convinced of his own rightness and his own intellect and his own ability to carry out shit.
Yeah.
And nobody cares. Nobody wants to listen to him. Nobody cares. And it's like, you know, he's a pain in the ass.
Yeah.
He's so convinced. He's just it's a little different with him, I guess, but it's like, but it's the same thing. I don't know why I end up having to do that all the time, but I do. A lot of times.
Well, I imagine no one ever has to give you this direction. Hey, Paul, could you come in hot?
You know, though, I do. I would say, though, that no, it's true. It's true. But I would say that more than you might think, I have people be kind of like, you know, just really get more weight. And I'm like, okay, I'll do it. But more than you would think.
Yeah?
More than you would think. Increasingly.
Bring it up a little?
As I'm getting older, I definitely am like, I just want to be quieter. I just want to sit and be quieter.
Yeah?
Because I'm old. Getting old.
I know. It's weird to feel that, isn't
it? Yes. I'm getting old.
But this movie, you've worked with Alexander Payne before.
Yeah.
You know, it's one of those kind of hard to define genres where, you know, essentially it's mostly comedy.
Yeah.
But it doesn't play out in a standard comedic structure.
No. Yeah. It's not jokey.
But also the ending is not, there's no kind of reunion or it's a dramatic ending.
Yes. And there's no great transformations or anything like that. There's no lessons learned. There's no big lessons learned, clearly learned in any way.
Well, you get
there's a little
humbled.
Movement forward. Yes. Yes.
I mean, the transformation
but is he gonna
happens.
Change? Is he really going to change much, that guy? Will he go off? Because people have said to me about this movie.
Yeah.
You know, at the end, I take a sip of cognac and spit it out the window. They're like, so he's not going to drink anymore. I'm like, no, he's going to keep drinking. I'm like, you know,
That was a fuck you to the dean.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
And so it's like, lessons are learned, but will they stick? I don't know.
Well, I think the lesson is, like, it's interesting about transformation, like, as being a objective of dramatic narrative.
Yes.
Because, like, you know, is it enough that you took the action you did at the end of that movie?
Yes.
To say that that character transformed? I'd say yes.
Would you? It could be, yeah.
And I don't want to give away the ending.
I think it's definitely a change.
You give up your entire
comfort of existence. He does give up everything. But how much did he want to get out of there anyway? Was he tired of it anyway? And this is a way
Yeah, but
out.
He was a dreamer, and he lived in this fantasy of what he would do, which is write a book. And,
Never going to do.
Well, you don't think he's driving away and he's going to make it to Greece.
No, but I think there's people who do, though, want that to be the case.
Right, but the second half of that story is what we assume happens, what we don't want to think about happens to those guys in the coffee shops.
Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly. That's right. Yeah. So what you're saying is true, but I do think some people want to play it out as a bigger transformation than it might be. I don't know. All I'm saying is I don't know.
Now, I'm going to discuss an issue I had with that movie, because I'm not going to talk to Payne about it. But and it's like it's minor because I enjoyed the movie.
Yeah, okay.
But just like in your understanding of the script, when all the other kids get on the helicopter, where the fuck are they going?
They're going skiing somewhere, aren't they? They're going
all of them, even the two
trip.
Little ones.
Yeah, I think
the Korean kids going skiing.
I think they're just all going to go.
Yeah. Well, that was clear.
Yeah,
but it was like,
saying
is like,
I would say
we had to get rid of the four kids.
Alex, yes, they did. And Alexander gets asked this question, and I see him.
He does?
And he goes, and he says, "What is the phrase?" It's like the Greek Deus ex machina. Right, God in the machine, God from the machine. He's like, it's a little bit Deus ex machina.
Wow,
it's a little bit like something has to happen. Yeah,
that's
to get them
like
out of
code
there.
For a script problem.
Okay. I mean, it's
Deus ex machina. It's like, look, let's just do it. Yeah. The story's strong enough. It's not going to...
It can sustain it. It can hold it. People will go with it. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Deus ex machina. In other words, we don't have another solution for this.
I would like to think the two young kids are going to sit in the ski lodge.
Okay,
maybe they won't
go
skiing.
Sure. And they were able to track down the missionaries to get permission.
Mormon kid. Yeah.
They were able to find the Mormon parents.
Now you're thinking about it way more than I think anybody did.
No, Deus ex machina.
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
It wasn't a problem for me in the story.
It didn't mar your experience.
No, but I was sort of like, where'd those kids go?
I think, I don't know that you're alone in that feeling.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
interesting.
I think some people are like a little too convenient. I didn't think it was too convenient, but that's me. I'm on board.
I'm on board with the job. But the weird thing is like, it's only because of, the convincing reality of the movie.
Yeah.
That things like that happen in movies all the time.
Yes, yes.
You know what I mean?
True.
It's like all of a
it's
sudden.
True.
Like I watched Cinderella Man last night. I don't know if I think I mentioned
really?
That. I watched it again. Because I was like, maybe I should, just
brush up on.
Well, it's a weird thing, and I've started to do it more. Like I've seen many of your movies, but I don't always remember the movies, right? Mm-hmm. And that was a big one. It was nominated for an Oscar.
Mm-hmm.
And I watched it, and I was only going to just kind of get a feel, but then I'm in, I got to do the
whole
thing.
That's pretty that one's very rousing.
And but again, do you have a problem with the character actor title?
No.
Right.
I don't really necessarily know what it means, but it's like, no, I don't. I mean, I think I knew what it used to mean. I don't really know what it means now.
No.
I don't know. Like what it used to mean was sort of William Demarest is going to show up and be the cranky bus driver or something.
It still means that.
Bill Demarest. Does it though?
Who do we got for this show?
Bill Demarest is going to show up and be the cranky janitor. I guess it is what it still means. Is that what it still means?
Let's see if we get Giamatti.
He's going to show up and be the feisty trainer.
Giamatti.
He'll be the feisty teacher. He'll be the crusty but lovable. What is crusty but lovable? That's Network. Lovable. That's still what it means. No, I have really no problem with it then, if that's what it still means. Because it's like, you'd be the crusty but lovable hotel manager or something.
Yeah.
Yeah. Then if that's what it means, I really have no problem with it, because I love those guys.
Yeah. Well, I
love that stuff.
But it's a great character because, you're able to do whatever.
Oh, Cinderella Man?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, because that scene where she shows up at his apartment, it's like, it's great.
It's great. Yeah. 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 No, yeah, yeah. It's
and
fun.
There's some emotion into it.
Yes. Yeah. It's a little.
Now, when you're working like with someone like Russell Crowe, like, you know, what is that experience for you? Are you coming at it from a different place generally, or do you not think about that?
No. Didn't. No, with him, it wasn't different. No. Because he's pretty, like, straightforward now he does it. There wasn't anything. It didn't feel different in any way, no.
Yeah, have you had experiences on set where you're like, all right, he's going to do this work and I'll just wait over here?
Yeah. I did a movie with Jim Carrey where he did this full-on, like, I'm immersed all the time thing.
Oh, the Andy Kaufman movie?
Man on the Moon.
Yeah. He's immersed all the time in whatever it is.
Yes, that's true. That's true. But he really did the whole nine yards, like the Daniel Day-Lewis thing.
Yeah.
Who I hear that when you do it with him, it's like you don't really notice it in a way. It's he's so in it that
he's so good that you believe you're hanging out with Abe Lincoln.
Exactly. Well, that's what people I know who did that said. They walk in the room and it's like, oh my God, it's Abe Lincoln.
Let's go talk to Abe Lincoln.
But that people said that's what it was like. I'm telling you.
How'd you not get in that movie?
I don't know. I was a little irked that I wasn't in that. I wasn't the crusty but lovable, Secretary of Commerce
or Congressman.
Congressman.
There definitely was a role in there for you.
Congressman from, wherever, North Carolina or whatever. Crusty but lovable. But, a nice turn at the end, something. Oh, he comes around at the end and votes. Yeah.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, I know. No, I was a little bit like, I can't be in that. But I wonder
that Every actor in Hollywood is in that movie.
But also it was a little bit like, maybe it would be confusing if I did that because I'd been
John Adams already?
Yes, exactly. That might have been confusing to me.
Do you feel like you're typecast? It sometimes?
Yeah, sometimes I think the bigger roles that I do are kind of similar. Yeah. Which and is, it's
is
all
it
right,
okay?
though. Yeah, I did because they're good roles.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's like I have good stuff to do in them.
Yeah. So you really, you still like having
The smaller roles got more interesting as time went on.
Yeah?
I got more kind of varied, felt a little bit more varied in the smaller things.
Now, and this is not meant as an insult, it's just meant, I haven't seen Billions.
Uh-huh.
Now, it must be odd that at this point in your career, there are some people that only know you from Billions.
Yeah, well, that's always weird, though.
Yeah.
The, whatever the hell is the thing, then it becomes the thing people know you for a while.
And it's been on for a while.
It was on forever. It was on
it's
for
done?
7-8 years. It's done.
But, like, I was in radio for years, and your big break was, a guy that was very familiar to me.
That actual guy?
Well, just the radio.
Yes, the radio.
That guy exists in radio.
You were in radio. That's right.
Air America.
Yes, that's right. You did all of that.
Yeah, for a couple years.
What's his name? Sam Cedar?
Yeah, Cedar, sure, yeah.
Is it still?
He does a thing. Sam and I did a streaming video show when no one was able to stream yet. And we did that.
Interesting.
We go way back, Cedar.
Yes.
And
I did a thing with him years ago. I did a pilot. I did a sitcom briefly with Sam Cedar.
Yeah.
Many years ago.
He was funny.
Really funny.
He really was.
Really nice guy.
He's very funny in a very specific way, but he's also very opinionated, argumentative, and relentless. He does a thing called Majority Report.
Uh-huh.
And it's still like that's his bread and butter. He's a progressive podcast guy.
Nice. Very good.
Yeah. But, like, do you think that Private Parts, not, it puts you on the map, but on some level, you've been in that zone forever?
Well, yeah. I mean, definitely. And it was really fun. And it definitely was something I had more to do than I'd ever had to do before. But, I kind of, there's some funny way in which somebody asked me once, when you were a kid and you did plays in school and grade school.
Yeah.
And they said, what was the thing that you did in grade school and you loved? And I was like, when I was in the fourth grade, we did the Pied Piper of Hamelin. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like it was a little kid's thing with the Pied Piper of Hamelin. Somebody said, who'd you play? And I said, the corrupt mayor who rips the Pied Piper off, who says, I'm going to pay you to get all the rats out of town.
Yeah.
And then it's like, fuck you, I'm not going to pay you once all the rats are out of town. I'm like, kind of been doing the same thing ever since. I was in the fourth grade. I'm kind of playing the petty bureaucrat. No matter what it is, it's like kind of the petty bureaucrat to the guy that I play a little bit. You know what I mean? The kind of the small man who wants the power, but he can't really handle the power or something.
But that's not like really who you are.
I don't think so.
Yeah.
I don't think so.
But it must be
but
fun.
That's an interesting question. That's a whole question of how much is it you? How much is it, like, not you?
How long do you spend with that question daily?
Well, it's an, it's an interesting question. It's not every day. It's not a daily thing. But it definitely comes up. But that's an interesting question because you do sort of sometimes go, what is it about me that seems to be, that seems to translate into something, these kind of weird guys like this, complicated guys? I don't know.
Well, is there a role that you're dying to do?
I think, I don't know if there's anything I'm dying to do. I do, somebody asked me this again, and I said, I would like to do the guy who, I'd like to do the guy who doesn't talk very much. I'd like to do the kind of like, the silent guy.
That would be so hard for your fans. Like, what's wrong with Paul?
Why is he not talking?
Why is he not yelling?
He's not yelling, he's not talking. Yeah. Because I always have to play really hyper-articulate people. And it's like, I'd like to play the kind of guy who just, I don't, for whatever reason, doesn't talk as much.
Interesting.
I did do one movie where I didn't have to talk as much, and I actually-
What movie was that?
It's, I can't remember the title.
Yeah.
It's a thing I did, it's a, talk about the accent going in and out.
Yeah.
I did a Canadian accent. It was with Paul Rudd, and I can't remember the title.
Oh, it's all right.
Oh my God.
It happens. You've done 100 movies.
But this is the memory thing I was talking about.
Well, like, but you've done 100 movies. You know, there's some guys like, you know.
It'll come to me.
I've learned it, like, with certain actors. Like, they do movies. The only thing that gets them to do the movie, it's like, all right, so it's 2 weeks and it's here? Okay.
2 weeks and it's here, or it's like it's 2 weeks and it's Australia or something like that. That's a big thing.
As long as it's not a month. Or
well,
2 months.
Yeah, you don't mind? I don't know. I don't mind that. As long as I'm not having to carry the thing.
Yeah, yeah.
I enjoy going to.
Oh, yeah?
Sure.
Yeah.
No, travel was a big part of it. So,
your father, before he tragically died very young, was a baseball commissioner, and it seems like that was a big part of your life, baseball. Or
big,
your
fan. I was not a big fan. No,
because I was going to wonder if you ever did a baseball movie.
I have done a baseball movie.
Which one?
I did a weird baseball movie.
Oh.
It's called. It's called. The Phenom.
Okay.
It's a weird little, it's a good little movie, though, actually.
Yeah.
And it's about a pitcher who gets the, you know, he gets the.
Do you play a scout or a manager?
Hold on. It's about a guy. Hold on, steady. This might come as a surprise to you. It's about a guy, a pitcher who gets the yips. You know, he can't get it over the plate.
Oh.
And so I play as a sports psychologist.
Wow.
I know, big switch. And so I play a sports psychologist and. Ethan Hawke is in it and plays the kid's father.
Yeah.
It's actually a really
interesting
movie. Ethan's great in it.
He's an interesting actor. Ethan
Hawke. He's great.
Because he can really do it, and he's very intellectual about it.
Yeah,
and
he is, actually.
And he's
yeah.
very focused. I talked to him once, and it was like I never forgot it, where he got cast in Training Day with Denzel.
Uh-huh.
So what he did was, you know, not unlike a football team watching the other team's, you know, games.
Stealing their signal. Oh, right.
No,
okay.
Just like.
Yeah, studying their games.
He did that with Denzel.
He did that.
With all his movies, so he didn't get fucking eaten.
So he wasn't like getting in there and just being like, holy shit.
Well, just being like plowed under.
But he wouldn't have anyway, I don't
think. No, I don't think so, but I like the prep.
Yeah, that is
like
interesting.
That is just sort of like, all right, this is how he's going to come at me.
I just saw The Equalizer 3 on a plane.
God, they're Denzel. Satisfying, aren't they?
So satisfying. Holy shit, that movie was great.
The new one?
Great, yeah.
Oh, God. Okay, I'm going to watch
really
it.
It was really good. It falls apart a little bit at the end, but it was really good.
Really? Do the kids leave on a helicopter?
Oh, boy. No, but not, you know, not far from that. Not far from that. Yeah, and along those lines.
Yeah, yeah.
Along those lines.
Yeah.
It's good.
Yeah.
It's good. Really
it's satisfying.
Good.
I don't watch a lot of that stuff.
I like action movies.
You do?
Yeah.
What, do you watch the John Wicks?
Yeah, I like those. I haven't seen the latest one.
I haven't seen any of
them. That guy I mentioned before, Lance Reddick, my friend who died, he was in all of those.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I'd have to look at a picture of him. I'm sure I know who he is.
All
right, so what do you? So what's happening now? You got a big day?
No, actually, I have a very light day after this.
Oh, you
this.
Do?
This has been heavy.
Yeah.
This has been heavy.
What are you kidding? We've just laughed for an hour now.
I do a podcast.
No, you don't.
Yes, I do.
Okay.
I do. Do you really not believe me? Do you really think I come in here?
What are you kidding?
I did
everyone,
not steal your format, though.
No one
I know
stole
everybody
my
does it. Don't they?
Everyone has something. Yeah,
right.
I mean, but I don't own the format. It was just very, but you know,
but
this
you
sort
are
of,
kind of you're like the first person to do this.
With a thoughtful, candid, you know, full, candid, yes, you know, engaged conversation thing.
Yes, I suppose so.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You kind of are, though, right?
Yeah, I'll take that.
Okay.
So what are you doing with yours?
Mine's all about, like, esoteric weird shit.
Oh, like in what
UFOs,
what variety?
And stuff like that. Yep. Ghosts, things like that.
And
yeah, I do a thing called Chinwag with a guy who's a philosopher. He's a philosophy professor.
Wait, so you
at an art college in Chicago.
Okay, so but what's the angle? Like you
He's skeptical, I'm less skeptical, but
of ghosts?
We talk about all kinds of things. All kinds of things. We talked to a Roman historian, we talked to an historian in Egypt. We talked to a guy who's a psychedelics researcher. We talked to a dream and sleep. It's just whatever weird topic.
This is
us.
All part of the quest to be the guy in the coffee shop, Paul.
It is. No. It is. It full on is. You're not, it's not a joke. It really is.
Yeah, you're like,
it really is. It's fully embracing.
If I can only have the courage.
But it's to no fucking joke. That's how I say with all fucking seriousness and candor, I got tired of not talking about shit like this, Sasquatch and shit like this, and like precognitive dreams and stuff. Like I really did. Because I'm interested. And so I was like, I'm 56. Who knows how much longer I'm going to live? So I want to talk about this stuff.
But
and I have a buddy who likes to talk about it, too.
No, I get it. But, like, you know, I've gone through, you know, periods of that. Like,
Being interested in stuff like that.
Well, what happened to me, how I learned my lesson around managing my fucking mind.
Yeah.
Is that... you know, when I was younger, you know, I had I did a lot of cocaine. And I was out here at the Comedy Store, and, you know, it was right after college. I wanted to be a comic, and I got caught up with Kendison and that, world. And,
holy
like,
cow.
A lot of cocaine and a lot, no sleep.
Holy
so
cow.
So I got cocaine psychosis.
Right.
And I was pretty sure that there was, like, a very dark, mystical
conspiracy. So the next
conspiracy.
Stop is, like, sure, yeah.
So,
the
like,
Illuminati
no, everything was connected.
The JFK assassination and stuff like that.
That was part of that a little earlier. Yeah, that's now become QAnon. So you know where that goes.
Yes, right.
And I talked to you should listen to my episode with this guy, Robert Guffey, who wrote a book called Operation Mindfuck. Have him on your podcast.
I will. That sounds great. Okay. That's exactly the kind of thing.
Sure.
Yeah.
Well, what?
Not stealing your shit, though.
No, you're not. No, okay. But, like, I have to manage that, because if you have a propensity to the mystical.
Yes.
You know, you've got.
But are you a believer in it? Like, well, who knows? At that point, if you're doing a shit ton of cocaine and not sleeping, you might
But any conspiracy is satisfying because you're backloading a pattern.
Right.
So you know.
It's a narrative. Like, it's a satisfying narrative.
I remember, like, I wrote a book, and there's a scene where my buddy Jim worked in politics forever, like, in Washington for presidency. Like, he was, you know, he's an advanced guy, but he's a guy, a Washington guy. And I remember he takes me on this tour. This was, I think it might have been before cocaine psychosis, but I was always heading there. And I'm like, you know, we're walking around Washington, and I'm like, you know what this is about?
Right.
It's the Freemasons.
Yeah, absolutely. The whole thing, laid out. Out in a pattern.
Exactly.
I know, yeah.
So I go off on this whole rip, and Jim looks at me and goes, Mark, people here just aren't that organized.
That's true.
That's absolutely true.
That's absolutely right.
And yet the Masons are the Masons.
Right.
You can become a Mason.
Yes. We could become Masons.
Of course.
Yes.
But you can't get the big, you know.
You can't get up to the top.
Sure, you know, and there's the whole sort of, you know, George Washington was wearing a Masonic apron at his inauguration.
But
was really...
you can see paintings of him wearing a Masonic apron.
Sure, but so
they have
fucking
them in the,
what?
In the, it's true. But all that shit is actually very boring. It's not anywhere near as interesting as you think it's going
to
be.
There's a, you should go, have you been up to San Francisco to the Freemason Hall? There's a,
no,
like, there's
a great one in San Francisco?
It's a huge one, and I've done comedy there. It's a beautiful place, but they have a fairly expansive Freemason museum.
Like history. I've been to the one in London, which is like the central one in London, where they have a painting of George Washington and Ben Franklin.
The Hellfire Club?
That's a whole other thing, though. Mm. That's not connected with the Freemasons.
No?
That's just like a sex club, isn't it?
I don't know. I think it's all kind of connected.
Illuminati's true, actually.
I got a bunch of books.
Cult.
You want some new books?
So some literature.
I'm ready to let go
pamphlets?
Of the books.
But you're absolutely right when you say that basically it's on track to be the fucking, the marginal weirdo at the university.
Oh, yeah.
Or it's just, yeah, it's interesting. It's exploring that.
You just don't have the guts, Paul.
I don't. I don't. I don't. I have to hide behind a microphone and do it.
Lock in,
man. Like,
just lock in and lose yourself.
I don't have the
guts. So the world would go like, holy shit, why is that guy at the protest?
But I think, oh my God, you mean to go full on that? That would be amazing, wouldn't it?
Sure. It happens, I'm sure. I've known fairly sane people.
Who have gone full on that way. Not like QAnon?
Yeah.
Like, really?
Yeah.
Actually, you're right. I actually know a guy.
Brain's kind of soft, dude.
I knew a guy who went that way. It's interesting because he was an old school psychonaut hippie guy.
Sure, of course.
From the 60s and 70s. And where that dovetails with the same thing, with the crazy right wing thing, it's fascinating.
Yeah, but
that
it was
weird,
all
the old hippie thing.
Yeah, but it was all a joke. Like, the Illuminati was a joke.
Yes,
it was a prank.
Yes, it's true. It was all a prank. It's all that Church of Bob shit. It's all that.
It was before that.
Yeah, it
was meant as a reaction to the John Birch Society.
Right. It's nice. Robert Anton Wilson and all that stuff.
Yeah, he was a joker.
It's a joke. Yeah. Was it really, though?
No, it's okay. I'm not going to do this with you. Maybe, have me.
Oh, will you be on my show?
Maybe.
Really?
Yeah. Where do you tape it?
You could be here. I just do it from my home.
Oh, you do it from
home.
The Zoom?
Yeah, I do it from a Zoom.
To tell you how I managed to keep this shit out?
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
That would be really interesting, actually.
You kind of have to. You got to make a decision.
There's so
much coming at you, and because of algorithms, it's, you know.
It's even easier.
Well, yeah, radicalizing people one way or the other is like, it happens
easy.
In days.
Yeah, so hours, matter of hours, it sounds like. But that's that whole thing of the accessibility and all this stuff. It's gotten too easy.
I'll show you some books. Easy.
You got some books?
I do have
some literature, some pamphlets.
I have an old.
But that's exactly it. Like at one time, you had to mimeograph this shit off. You had to have a mimeograph machine, staple it together. If you wanted to find this stuff,
well, you know,
it
maybe
was hard to find any of this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Even the UFO stuff, it was all harder to find.
But what you really got to track with a lot of the propaganda that is conspiracy oriented is the right wing drive of it. Because it essentially feels
like a conservative impulse.
It's a divide and conquer mindfuck.
Yeah,
you know. So the actual corporate elites can just keep everybody fucked up and confused and fascist if necessary.
Yeah, yeah. But do you think people have a propensity and natural hunger to want just fascism anyway?
Of course.
Yeah.
It's a lot easier than tolerance.
Way easier. Way easier.
Hey, if everyone thinks the same.
So much easier. Just turn it all over to that guy. He'll do everything.
And also,
so
just so like, you know, we can hate all these people and even kill them.
Yeah.
Great. I'm annoyed.
Like
I've been annoyed for
democracy. Is just a drag.
It's exhausting.
It's too hard.
Yeah. Let's not sell it too hard. We're kind of like, well, it makes sense, Mark. I'm like, where's this going? Jesus, Paul. Maybe you shouldn't do the podcast.
No, that's interesting, though. The marginal guy. Yeah.
Good talking to you.
Yeah, really good talking to
Thanks,
you.
Thanks, man.
Yeah, man.
How was that? That's what we do here. That is what we do here. The Holdovers is playing in theaters and available to stream on Peacock. What a great guy. I didn't even get his phone number. I should have got his fucking phone number so we could hang out. Can someone just get me Paul's phone number? Thank you. Hang out a minute, you guys. Man, 1,500 episodes is a lot to take in if you're new to WTF. So for full Marin subscribers, we do archive deep dives where we walk you through some of the memorable episodes in our back catalog. We recently did one about our 200th episode.
John Mulaney at the time asked, what do you think is edgy in comedy? And I'm interested to know if your answer to that is different than it was back then.
Well, I think it seems to me, for me, to be vulnerable enough to take real emotional risks on stage, and figure out where, you know, the humor is in that, and also to stay, to sort of, you know, keep your heart in the game with that stuff.
The answer you gave when he asked that was, it was instant. You said being completely honest, that's edgy, which I hear as different from what you just said. They're related. But what you're saying now about being vulnerable and showing that vulnerability,
That's emotional honesty.
Exactly. And it reflects a maturity and some corrections you've had to make in your life about that idea of just being completely honest. Like, you have, over the course of the last 12 years, kind of redirected certain things because you feel there are things that can be kept personal, or there are things that don't have to be shared, or, you know, it's like that thing you've talked about with Louis when you told him he had to talk about the Oklahoma City bombing, right? Yeah. Like when he was going to do his Letterman show.
But that was different. I think that honesty can be, that a certain type of honesty can be in a defense mechanism, and it can be jarring, and it can be, you know, for effect.
Well, that's the funny thing. You were likening it to people who did edgy comedy for effect at the time in this episode. You were like, you know, it doesn't take much to be like, I don't know, the Pope licks my balls, or Jesus lives in my ass. I just love that those are your two examples.
Yeah, I kind of like, I'm going to bring that back. Jesus lives in my ass. To sign up for the full Marin so you can get bonus episodes twice a week and every episode of WTF ad-free, go click on the link in the episode description or go to WTFpod.com and click on WTF Plus. This is a little guitar piece I call Wouldn't Nicotine Be Nice? Now. Monkey and LaFonda, cat angels everywhere.